Smestions.
Well, this is take three. Thank you for downloading us. James Hopesmith, following the mention of the Travelling Wilburys last week,
yes.
Who would your dream supergroup consist of? And for a bonus, what would they be called?
So dream supergroup is members of another group,
yes.
From other groups.
So I'll go first, okay. And I'll say the Dodge Brothers with Elvis as the lead singer.
And there we go. There is no other answer. Well, Thank you very much.
What would you be called?
We would be called the...
Elvis and the Dodge Brothers.
Elvis and the Dodge Brothers, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
If you were going to assemble...
If I was going to assemble the greatest band Evs...
Yes.
Well, we'd have to have Patti Smith on vocals, I think... Stephen Fellows on guitar, Charlie Mingus on bass, or was it just too much messing around?
There's a lot of messing around.
And Karen Carpenter on drums.
Okay, well that's an interesting combination. Femi says, what in your view is something that still hasn't gone back to normal after the pandemic?
Well, I do think that personally, I'm still uncertain as to whether you shake hands with people. I was always a very firm believer in the firm handshake. You know, whoever you meet, whether it's adult, child, you know, male, female, doesn't make any difference.
Proper handshake.
But obviously, we all stopped doing that during the pandemic. And I now find myself uncertain as to whether if I see somebody or somebody, you know, says hello in the street, I would always shake their hand. And I realized that I haven't gone back to doing that because we've all become very germophobic. And obviously, because there is another kind of, you know, batch of, like, we've just done an interview today that ended up being remote because our guest tested positive for COVID this morning. So I think that probably the sort of the firm handshake hasn't gone back to normal.
You just reminded me that. So like when I'm at primary school age,
yes,
my dad used to give me handshaking practice. We to get a firm handshake,
Okay. He
would sort of, we'd shake hands and he would squeeze tight and then I would squeeze tight and he'd get tighter, harder.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And in the end, it was just a draw. You know.
Yeah.
But
I think it's good to learn a good firm handshake. And I it is true. I know this sounds like a ridiculous thing, that if somebody gives you a firm handshake, you do. Oh.
Well, I'll tell you the toughest handshake I ever had was the late great Sinead O'Connor, who basically bust my hand. And the most these both at Top of the Pops. The most feeble handshake was Lloyd Cole out of the Commotions.
Okay.
It was like kind of limp lettuce kind of thing.
Well,
it's interesting that you actually, I even remember the handshake.
There we go. God, that's fantastic. So, but Sinead O'Connor had a real...
Real hard handshake. Yeah, absolutely.
And there we go.
So something that hasn't gone back to normal after the pandemic. I'm not sure if this is correct. I was listening to the News Agents podcast last night and Lewis Goodall, who is excellent.
He
was talking about our memories not going back to normal. And he was saying
that's interesting.
And he was talking about the COVID inquiry at the moment and how people don't want to talk about it. That it was so horrendous for so many people that we don't want to talk about it. And he was talking, he'd read a book which was about, did they call it the Spanish flu at the end of the First World War?
I think so, yeah.
It killed more people than the First World War. How many songs do you know about it? How many movies have you seen about that horrendous moment in world history? Answer, I don't know any. And he said, it's almost as though it's so horrific, we don't want, people then, they didn't want to talk about it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's absolutely
right.
Which
I thought was...
it's also the fact that, as people are probably aware, during wartime, people want to watch movies about upbeat, happy things. You know, when you're in the middle of something really terrible, you don't want to watch horror movies. You don't want to watch grim documentaries. You know, what you want to watch is, I mean, and since we are, you know, we're still all in the aftermath and the aftershock of COVID, perhaps the last, I mean, I remember people saying, oh, well, there'll be all these dramas about, you know, lockdown and isolation and things. But in fact, the one that struck a nerve was a film that Soderbergh had made many years before that just happened to chime with it.
Colin in Kansas. It was recently announced that Warner Brothers is shelving the upcoming film Coyote vs. Acme for a tax write-off. Last year, the same happened to Batgirl and Scoob Holiday Haunt. Meanwhile, streaming services like Disney Plus announced dozens of shows and movies are being purged to reportedly get larger tax breaks. Warner Discovery removed over 40 pieces of media after the merger. For instance, Netflix quietly removed Mike Flanagan's Hush. Without a physical release,
really?
These films and shows are erased from existence. But Physical media is also becoming scarce. Retailers like Best Buy are stopping the sale of DVDs and Blu-rays. This raises a serious question. How can we protect the films and shows we love if they can be deleted for a few dollars on a spreadsheet? Am I wrong to be concerned?
No, you're not wrong to be concerned. In fact, this has been the subject of some discussion recently, I think, to which you were alluding. Whenever we talk about the DVD going away, Blu-ray going away, all the rest of it, all the films that I really love, and so let's default to Silent Running, Exorcist, Doodle and the Blue Cat. I have hard media copies of them in several different formats. The reason being because I used to live somewhere where the internet was very, very poor, so I could never rely on streaming services anyway, but also because it was possible that they'd be removed from the streaming services, or as was the case with the French Connection recently, the owners of the streaming service would change the product. And I have always said to journalists, if you're a journalist and you're writing stuff, keep hard copies of it. If you're writing stuff for a website or you're writing stuff for magazines or, you know, a newspaper, but I remember somebody once said, oh, I saw Mark Kermode going into a shop and buying The Observer. How sad to buy a newspaper you write for. To which the answer is, I'm archiving. Also, I love The Observer. That's why I'm writing for it. But keep hard copies of everything that you write. Keep your own backups of everything that you write. Because at some point, that publishing company that you're writing for or that streaming company that you're doing, you're making content for, they'll stop. The content won't be there anymore. I have video or now DVD copies of all the documentaries that I made. No, why would you want that? They're available online. Well, they might be today, but they might not be tomorrow. So yeah, if you have anything that you know and love, get a hard copy of it. Put it in your attic if you want to, but keep a hard copy of it because everything online could disappear tomorrow.
Jake says, what is a terrible song by an otherwise brilliant artist? A terrible song. So a brilliant artist with a terrible song. I think I have the winning answer.
Okay, I'll let you go first in that case. Go
My
on.
My Ding-a-Ling by Chuck Berry. One of the pioneers of rock and roll with the most pathetic, truly excruciating song of all time. And it got to number his only number one in this country. Was
that
my,
right? It was his only number one?
My Ding-a-Ling. Now, I'm a huge fan of Paul Simon. He did a song once called Cars Are Cars. It's terrible. I mean, it really, really is terrible. But it's a momentary blip. So this has to be a brilliant artist with a terrible song.
Wow. I mean, well, I mean, Paul McCartney, who I think is hey, I'm a bit of a going out on a limb here, but I think he's an absolute genius. You know, I think
yes.
Paul McCartney wrote a couple of songs that were just like unforgivably bad. I mean, the Frog Chorus is probably good, really, isn't it? Because I know he was, you know, he had the whole thing about that was a kind of labor of love. And but there he did write a couple of
Elvis came out with a couple of shockers.
Elvis didn't write anything. Elvis used to get publishing rights, but Elvis didn't write anything. So, are we
There's
talking
terrible
about...
terrible song by... and so.
Oh, well, Elvis, the list as long as your arm. I mean, you know, the Elvis Christmas album starts really well and then tails off really,
okay,
really fast.
That's good.
You know, yeah, no, I mean, Elvis made entire box sets of terrible stuff.
Dr. Catherine Bateson.
And I love Elvis.
We know that.
Just to be clear.
Yes.
You know.
Dr. Catherine Bateson, historian of the American Civil War and Irish-American wartime songs, Royal Historical Society fellow, long-term listener, first-time emailer to this iteration of your show, huge Lord of the Rings nerd, winner of 7 back-to-back swimming gala races at the age of 14 because no one wanted to do the races, and enormous fan of Mad Blood Stirring. Well, in which case, your question is on. So there's a preamble, but then the question is, do you or any of the listening congregation put on a comforting favourite movie to watch on a plane to deal with turbulence? To summarise Catherine's first paragraph, she was coming back from honeymoon and terrible turbulence, and she watched Lord of the Rings,
yes.
The Fellowship of the Ring, actually, which she found enormously reassuring. So would there be a movie that you'd put on to calm a troubled mind?
Well, if you're referring specifically to turbulence, as in the plane being buffeted
yes,
around
by
the elements, I don't know that any movie would take my mind off that. If you're referring to turbulence of a more general kind, I can tell you, as I've said this before, the good lady Professor Her Indoors watched Love Actually 3 times on a flight because she was distressed about being away from her family, by which I think she would mean our kids rather than me. Mm-hmm. I think that was more of a huzzah. And so she put it on, and she, you know, and that was really when the kind of the joke about us just watching Love Actually over and over and over again began, because she found it just calmed her. So for all the things that she thought was wrong with it and blah, blah, it just calmed her soul. If I was on a plane and I was feeling edgy and I wanted something, you know, something to, I'd watch a comedy. I'd, you know, if Splash was on, I'd watch Splash, or, you know, like a Laurel and Hardy or a Buster Keaton, or a, you know, something which is like slapstick comedy, because I just find slapstick comedy makes me laugh all the time, and I can't, nothing else will get in the way of it.
Bob Fenton, Dear Andy and Red, what do you consider to be the most overrated film? I cannot understand why people think Shawshank Redemption is one of the best movies of all time. A Man Escapes Through a Hole in the Wall, 2 hours and 20 minutes, come on.
Well, the
many thanks for the entertainment, by the way.
The Shawshank question is interesting, because I have just written a new afterword for the book that I wrote for the BFI about the Shawshank Redemption. And if you've ever read that book, you may well not have done, obviously, but it's a monograph, so it's a short book. I said that, unlike Red, I'm a man who doesn't get things, and one of the things I didn't get is the Shawshank Redemption. And I talk about how when I first saw Shawshank, I thought it was good, but I just didn't get why it was turning up as everybody's favorite movie. And then in the course of Shawshank, the redeeming feature, the documentary, and then the book that I wrote for the BFI, what I was trying to do was to go, why is it that this fine film has become what it is? And I end up coming up with a kind of thesis about it being about, you know, religion in a religion-free world and the church of the cinema. So I actually don't think Shawshank is overrated. I think that what it is that it means something very profound to the people that it touches, but it may not be immediately apparent what that thing is. In terms of the most overrated film, I mean, are we talking about overrated in terms of Oscar winners? Because I think you'd have to say that the most overrated film of all time is Driving Miss Daisy, because it won the Oscar for Best Picture, and yet it is so... It not only was it not the best picture of the year, it wasn't even the best Morgan Freeman movie of the week that it was released. So just in terms of absolute...
I enjoyed it, I have to say.
Yeah, no, it's fine. It's fine, but it's not a Best Picture. And then the question was, what's the most overrated? Mm-hmm. Winning the Oscar for Best Picture is the most rated you can be, you know. I mean, I know people want to say, well, Citizen Kane. Of course, Citizen Kane isn't overrated. I mean...
The Piano, I would always just chip
in. Oh, that's a very good choice. Very good choice.
Phil in Helston, have you ever considered what is the greatest final frame of a film? There are so many different awards for acting and sound and screenplay, yet to my knowledge, no one has ever considered what is the best final, last, ultimate frame of a film. I cannot envisage any movie ever beating Walter Matthau's face in the final frame of The Taking of Pelham 1, 2, 3. So that's my suggestion.
Good and tight. That is a really good choice.
It's literally the final frame.
Yeah,
because I was thinking in Carrie, the hand is not the very final frame. Is it the hand out of the ground?
No, because it then cuts back to her waking up on the hospital bed. The Walter Matthau at the end of Taking a Pelham 1, 2, 3 is genius, because it's sneeze, Gesundheit, and then the door opens again and it's Walter Matthau's face beyond, and the face got, I got you.
I think you've kind of had a good idea, Phil, and then you spoiled it by coming up with the winning answer.
Yeah, no, that is brilliant. I was going to suggest the very final frame of St. Maud, which is less than a second.
Yeah, that's what I've written as well, St. Maud.
Oh!
Yeah.
Did we both completely independently?
Yeah.
And I had a really...
It's so memorable as a final frame.
Astonishing. And I had a really interesting conversation with the director, and she was talking about how long they worked on how long that shot should be. Like, should it be a fifth of a second or a sixth of a second or this many frames or that many frames? And it's absolutely, yeah, astonishing.
Carl says, what single change has massively improved your mental health?
Well... I mean, I don't know, does doing therapy count as a change?
Yeah, a change from what you were doing before. So.
I mean, on a slightly serious note on this, the reason that I started doing therapy is that the good lady Professor Herring Dawes thought that I really should start to get a handle on my anxiety, particularly since I was, you know, turning 60 and, you know, life starts to change for you after a while. And she thought, look, you know, if this was a physical problem anyway, you would go and get it dealt with, and you really should probably do something about this. And if I have any regret, it is that I didn't do it earlier. I wish that I had done it earlier, because I have it's not for everybody, I understand, but I have found therapy hugely productive and it has really improved my mental health.
Well, my answer would be leaving Radio 2.
Yes,
which is I don't wish to open old wounds.
No.
And but it was at root a catastrophic management decision, but I made things worse by hanging around, so I should have bailed out a lot sooner. So
I remember a conversation with you once, and you can say if you don't want this in, you can tell them to cut mm-hmm. this out. Okay, I had a conversation with you once during that period, which was so unpleasant and so badly mishandled. And I called you, and I think I just called you to say, are you doing all right? Because obviously it was a difficult period. And I said, what are you doing? And you said, I'm standing outside Radio 2 trying to think of a really good reason not to go in.
Yeah.
And I just thought it was heartbreaking.
No, I was probably trying to think of a really good reason to actually go in, because what I wanted to do is just not go in.
And, yeah, it was,
No, absolutely. And my mistake was, I thought, I didn't want to go because I thought that's what they wanted. So I thought, I'm going to hang around, I'm going to make this a success, but
And then Scala came along and said, Brave New World over here.
We'll have you. Yeah. Anyway, yes, and I'm very grateful to them. But, sometimes you just have to, it's difficult to make a call sometimes about
those things. Impossible. But it was just horrible to see you it was just horrible to see you, because you're not, usually you are grumpily sure of yourself.
Yes.
To see you miserable was horrible.
Emily in California.
Okay.
What fact do you know that sounds like a conspiracy theory but isn't?
Oh, God.
My favorite is that in the 1970s, the Church of Scientology had members secretly infiltrating 136 US government agencies, foreign embassies, and consulates in order to destroy documents and investigations into the church, which does indeed sound like a conspiracy theory.
There was an interview that was done recently. Bill, what's he called? Bill Maher, Mayor, I will remember us from Cannibal Women in the Avocado Jungle of Death, interviewing Oliver Stone. In which Oliver Stone, yeah, exactly. And Bill Maher said, is there a conspiracy theory you don't believe? Which I thought was absolutely on the
money. Occasionally you come across stats, Emily, or facts that would lead to the kind of stuff Oliver Stone would love. For example, and maybe Oliver Stone knows this already. In 1975, the CIA had a heart attack gun, which you fired at someone, and the darts contained frozen water. Or ice, I believe, as it's known. And
were they made of ice?
It had shellfish toxin in it, so that the dart goes into your body.
The dart is made of ice.
Yes, and
it melts and disappears.
So that disappears, but the shellfish toxin gives you a heart attack. So that all is left. So you've had a heart attack. There is probably a tiny little pinprick.
That's a real thing.
And that's a real thing. So 1975, Nixonian America.
And I'll...
A heart attack gun. So we'll finish on an uptick here.
Excellent.
The first one, question from Elizabeth. What is a little thing which restores your faith in humanity? Mine is when a bus driver stops at a bus stop to wait for someone who is running for the bus, sometimes from some distance, or stops and reopens the door for such a person after the bus has started to pull away.
Yeah.
So I guess it's sort of random acts of kindness and selflessness, isn't it? Although I was going to give this answer, and now I realise the whole thing is that Elizabeth says a little thing which restores your faith in humanity. So this is the very opposite of what she's talking about.
Okay.
This is a very big thing. In all the horribleness of Israel-Gaza, there is a man called Yusuf Ziadna, who's an Arab, a Bedouin, who lives in Rahat, which is in Israel. And he's a minibus driver. And when there was the massacre at that pop festival at the party, the Supernova party, he rescued 30 Jewish Israelis, went back and back and back, saved people. And in all the terrible stuff, you come across examples like that, which is, I agree, not a little thing at all. And you think, okay. Well, more power to Yusuf and more people like him.
Yes, that is a very, very big thing. So, I agree with your analysis of it. So let me end this on a genuinely little thing that restores my faith in humanity. Lost property offices at railway stations. And the reason is we've all lost things. We've all left things behind, We've all left things on a train and it's, And then you go to the lost property. I don't suppose anyone's handed in, and you just assume that the answer is is no. And if the answer is yes, the person who handed that in, they didn't have anything to gain from it. They could have left it on the train. They could have taken it for themselves. They could have done anything with it. If it got handed in, it means that somebody took the bother to look at something. And think, I don't know who that belongs to. I don't know whether they got any important, not even though like an expensive thing, you know. And they bothered to take it to the right place and do the thing because in the off chance that somebody with whom they have no connection or contact at all. And I don't know whether you've ever done this. If you've ever gone to a lost property office and said, I don't suppose you've got a pair of black gloves. And they've gone, oh, actually, yeah, we have. It restores your faith in humanity.
Yeah, which is precisely what Elizabeth was asking. Thank you very much indeed for the questions and indeed the schmestions. Keep them as short as possible if you can. Thank you very much. And send them to correspondence@curbandmayo.com. The new take will be with you on Friday, as will take two.